left the Christmas tree.
The Christmas party at his mother's.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the Christmas, well, the tree for the, every all the workers.
Oh, are we on now or
yeah,
whatever?
I'm rolling.
Okay.
Well, let's sort of start with wherever you want to start. Leave it that way. With Moortown or your family.
Well, okay, we'll try to start at a beginning. As I remember it, you did mention about Moortown and made mention about the Mad River.
Let's hold on 1 second.
The other thing that happens is when there are sudden noises and stuff like that, it's hard to edit around. You can't edit around. Okay.
Mentioning the Mad River, and I always now at this time remember how the river, what an important part the river played in all of our lives, and me as a small child or as a young boy, because Moortown was really a lumber town. With a few farms on the hills, but it was primarily a lumber town, and everyone depended on the mills operating for work. And they were employed by, at that time, by Ward Lumber Company, which was actually a business that was started by my great-grandfather, H.O., Hiram Ward, who originally settled on Ward Hill, and as time went on in the late 1800s, at the risk of repeating myself, my great-grandfather, who was a farmer on settling on Ward Hill, which is part of the loop that goes across from present-day Harwood, goes up the Dowsville side and comes around down the Ward Hill side, Dowsville Brook being the brook that drains that watershed, had a farm there, and somehow he started in the lumber business, or had a clapboard mill, which we still have today, one, and he set up a water power sawmill, clapboard mill, on Dowsville Brook, of which there's some old remnants of it still there, and that would have been in or about the 1870s to 1880 era. And ultimately he moved to Moortown and bought what was a grist mill, a water-powered grist mill on the Mad River. And he ended up having a mill on each end of town, of Moortown, probably about a third or half a mile apart, both of which got their power source from the Mad River in some very, very clever ways that they did it more than just, I mean, it became a little more sophisticated as years went on. So I'm not sure when the dams across the Mad River, which were quite substantial because the Mad River can be a pretty serious river in the springtime or other times. And each of these mills had a dam. This is very important why I talk about the river and the importance of it. So all there was water power. So these two mills, which I'm sure employed probably 20-odd people or more at that time, back in the early 1900s. In the summertime, there was a constant constant problem with the flow of the Mad River. There's only a few times in the year when it seemed like everything worked just right, and the river was right to produce enough power, which might have been the equivalent of nowadays 100 horsepower, 125 horsepower, well, maybe more than that actually. There's a constant problem because in the wintertime, if it was too cold, the ice got so thick, and the flow of the Mad River, if we had a long stretch of cold weather, the flow of the Mad River got so low that they wouldn't be able to operate. So they had to consider that. And in the summertime, then we went to the spring, and that worked pretty well for a while, except that many things came down the river in the springtime, and keeping the racks clean, the water had to go through high racks, as it does today, and debris accumulates on them. But in the summertime, the water would build up in the evening and overnight. And once it had built up to the top of the dam, because there were the water was mill ponds, it set back for quite a long ways, and the water was stored. Because once again, the summertime, the Mad River can get to not much more than a real large brook. So the men would come to work like at 3 o'clock in the morning. Once the dam was full, they wanted to be able to utilize it. So they would come to work like at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and they would run the mill until 7 or 8 o'clock, and they would have used up all the water that had collected in the dam, and there wasn't enough flow to keep it going. So then they would go home, and the water would store up again. They'd wait 4 or 5 hours, and they would come back, and that's how they lived and worked off the water power. And I'm sure that worked with all dams all around New England, probably. It was a little unique in that there was a dam on each end of the town, so that the water that was stored in the upriver dam would end up down in the mill pond of the water for the other mill at the lower end of town. So that made a double storage for one mill. But anyway, later on, when I can remember more, it was a little more my time, auxiliary power came in. But it was always the river that, even then with the auxiliary power, it was always the river that decided how things were going, and was it going to be possible in the springtime when the ice went out, the dams would get these great ice jams. I can remember this so well as a child, and I'm sure I've mentioned this in some other interview, but I can remember more than once at a big dam at the lower mill where the clapboard mill is now, but it was the mill, the dam is no longer there. I can remember watching the men go out. One in particular would go out, and the water would get so that, or the dam would cause the ice to jam and set back, and people say, oh, it's going to flood the Moortown village. So these guys would go out, one in particular, and he had this big auger, big bit, and he'd stand there out with all the water and the ice sort of around. I mean, anything could have happened at any time. And he'd casually bore maybe a 2-inch hole down in these great huge blocks of ice and put dynamite in, and then they'd run their fuse over. And I can remember standing there watching this, and they'd blast the ice so that it could go and let the ice move on so that it didn't come back and flood the town. It was pretty exciting for anybody and pretty dangerous for the people that did it, although I never knew anybody to get hurt doing that. So the river, I don't know, we got through the spring and then the summer, and in the summer the dams had things called flashboards put on them. And flashboards are just a method of raising the dam up. The dams are sort of on top, were sort of flat and maybe 3 feet wide, and you could walk out in them, as we did. And you put in metal pipes, 2-inch metal pipes, and raise the dams up about 2 feet, because you've tried to store more water in the summertime. Peggy?
We're leaving.
Why don't you put Stash in the car?
I got to do the barn. I got to make some calls from out there.
Okay. And let's see, as far as the river, as far as the power for the mills from the river, in the fall, it was always a big problem with the leaves. The leaves were running, and the leaves would come down, and they would build up. Somehow they would fold around the fins in the racks that strained the water, the debris out of the water, and a guy would have to be there constantly, a man would have to be there constantly, raking the rack, and so the water could run down the penstock. And so anyway, the water played an important part in the economy of Moortown Village. But it was also a great source of recreation for everybody, adults and children. It seems like in the wintertime, when things were right, once the river got frozen and everything worked right as far as the snow conditions, that we skated like every night on the river, on the Mad River, as every place else did too, I'm sure. But it was a little different there because we skated on the Mad River behind Moortown Village, which was sort of the pond that would be building up, and the ice would be very thick. But at night, when the mill stopped, they would shut off drawing the water, so the water would start backing up, and the ice during the day would have a tendency to drop down. So then at night, it would have a tendency to start pushing the ice up again because the water down under there was slowly building up, and that was very exciting. But we skated on it, and the ice was very thick, but it would do some tremendous cracking. But we used to skate night after night. Always had a big fire, big bonfire. And used to play hockey. And I mean, it was just a social time. And the adults skated and everybody skated. On weekends, everybody skated. And of course, we just had to keep it shoveled off. And when it became a little rough, which it did from the skating and everything, the guys would chop a hole down through the ice, which was very thick. They chopped the hole like at 5 o'clock at night when the mill shut down, and as the water built up under the ice, it would come back and come out over the top of the ice and reflood it with an inch or two of water, which would freeze and make a nice smooth skating surface. It was a very good idea. So we used it for that, and of course when I was a child, several of us used to trap muskrat in the river. That was a big thing. I don't know that we ever caught a lot. Well, we used to catch a few at that, but that was always a very exciting thing to do. And so we would do that, and we had a few boats that we played around the river on. I have only one recollection of them cutting ice out of the river, which they did right in front of what is now the old creamery site. But they used to cut ice, blocks of ice, regularly. Because when I was a kid, they were still putting up ice. There were two ice houses in town, as I recall. One was a ice house that was, well, it was on the lower end of town. They both, I guess, sold ice to the public. And, but I can remember them getting the ice out, getting the ice, cutting the blocks. The blocks would float around there, and they had this special way of getting them out of the water. And then they'd have horses and wagons, and they slid them on and took them to the ice house. Because our company, Ward Lumber Company, had its own ice house as part of, because it had a store also. So I guess that was all part of the system. And they would put in a layer of ice and then maybe 6 inches of sawdust and then another layer of ice and more sawdust. And it worked well. It got us, got through the entire summer till the next year. So that was another use for the Mad River. Of course, at that time, I'm sure quite a lot of the wastewater from the houses went into the Mad River, as it did in all of these towns. But that didn't seem to cause any great problem. So, I guess the other thing I can remember about the river is that everybody was a little afraid of it, because it could be, I mean, we had a few substantial floods, and I don't remember the 27 flood, but it was always imprinted in my memory. I do remember the hurricane of 1938, and then the water was in the middle part and lower northerly part of the village. The water was well up in the houses. So you had a lot of respect for the river and what it was going to do. And we were constantly watching how high it was. If it started to rain, if it rained for 3 or 4 days, how high the river was going to get, was getting, and what was going to happen. That's pretty much my recollection of the Mad River, other than it was also a great place to get gravel out of the inside of the bends of the river where the gravel collected, which of course isn't acceptable now, but it was many roads and things. River gravel was considered one of the best things to put. The towns used it for redoing the town roads, all the dirt roads. So it supplied a lot of gravel at that time. I guess the lower downstream you were, the more gravel collected if the river was winding around, making turns.
A lot of the farmers, have quite a bit to say about that.
Now, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, remembering
yes.
back
and yes.
how important that was. And they
it was also, very important.
They also feel that, it didn't hurt. It was good for the river.
It was very good for the river. Now, I'm sure there are places where it isn't. I'm sure that people could show us why it isn't. But, I mean, when it makes its big S turns and it collects the gravel on the inside of the turn, that just pushes it farther out into the field the next time and the next time. And so many, many of us that are familiar with that feel that it's a real mistake in a lot of places not taking that gravel out and letting the river sort of keep its natural course, because the river has moved over in many places way more than its original width was. It isn't even where it used to be. But anyway, we aren't allowed to do that now. I might mention one other thing as far as the river and Ward Lumber Company was concerned, and this has only been told to me, but in the 27 flood, I can remember my grandfather telling me and being passed down that it took away well over 1 million feet of lumber that was stacked and drying, and you constantly had to have a big inventory in those times for lumber to be drying, and all of that was all taken away in the 27 flood. A little bit in the 38 hurricane too. So that was a consideration later on where we, what we use for lumber yards. That's, you know, my river recollections, that may be pretty much what I can recall about the river as such. Of course, the mills, the sawmills, were right on the river. I mean, like, they couldn't have been any closer to the river, so I suppose various things happened, and maybe a certain amount of debris got in the river from the sawmills. I'm sure it did. And in Moortown, I mentioned there was a creamery, and that was always right on the river. And the creamery used to have a certain amount of their waste went into the river, and that's always where the best fishing was there. Absolutely, because that's where the trout seemed to know it was the best place to. So that was a part that I can recall. My growing up in Moortown, not that we didn't have a wonderful growing up period. I mean, as I look back on it, it was great, but it was always involved with a fair amount of work, because my grandfather really didn't like to see anybody sitting around idle, wasting time. So we all the kids, or a lot of them, boys, and that at that time, could work, could have jobs, such as they were, but could have jobs in the summertime when we weren't in school. Our company used to plant, do a lot of reforestation, and many years we'd plant 50, even 100,000 seedlings in the springtime. So as those plantations started to grow up and got a little bigger, maybe they were 15 or 20 years old, once again, my grandfather was a great believer in pruning trees, which were mainly spruce and white pine. And so we would go in the woods. Well, the trees were pruned to make nice lumber, because nice lumber doesn't have a lot of knots and things in it, which are from limbs. So we would go in the woods with like 20 or 30 boys every day. Unfortunately, rain almost. If it rained, we'd still go. And we would prune the trees. We'd all take a row, and there'd be row after row. The trees were spaced usually 6 feet apart or 8 feet apart. And we'd go down those row of trees, and one boy would be sort of the, we'd take turns at this, but one boy would be the scorekeeper, and we'd get a scent, a tree. And we had special saws with like a pistol grip and a curved blade, and we'd prune the trees one after another, maybe up 8 feet high, or 8 feet would probably be all we could have reached at that time with the saw. And there were boys that could prune 100 trees a day, and they'd make a dollar. And we all took our, we all went in these, and a couple of pickups, and maybe an old station wagon, I can recall, and we all had our dinner pails, and couldn't wait, of course, for lunchtime or dinner, as we called it then, I guess. And so we'd work all morning long and sit down and eat, and then we'd work all afternoon pruning trees. And actually, the fact is that many of those trees now are, most of that is now merchantable timber. And in fact, much of it is being cut right now, and some of it is being cut in this land purchase that's been going on very recently, which you probably, I'm sure you are aware of. But really, his purpose of buying, of doing that, was that the hill farms, at that time, along in the 1918 and on, were people weren't able to really make a living for themselves on the hill farms. It was very difficult, so they were leaving them, and he would buy the farms and all the meadowland. That is what he used to set out the trees for. I mean, used it as a, otherwise they would grow up to, ultimately, over several cycles, they'd grow up to timber, but it would take so many cycles. This way they were immediately producing, and it was a great plan. And of course his plan was that there'd always be timber and logs for the mills. And it was an admirable plan. He was a conservationist. And in fact, some of the classes, in fact, year after year, a couple of busloads would come from Syracuse University, the State College of Forestry there, to look at these plantations and make studies on them and see how it was working out. And so that was an advantage in a way that we had as children that maybe the children don't have today, in that we could work doing that. Of course, we all worked doing haying, and as everybody did, but somehow, maybe there was more work for the, well, the boys that lived on farms, were part of a farm family. There was no question they had all the work they could do too, but it was a little different. The boys in the village, to be able to do that, it worked out real well.
How did your grandfather get the idea of replanting trees? Did he ever talk with you about that, or did it?
I'm not sure whether he got it, whether he became conservation-minded from his father, Hiram, or I wish I really knew that, but I don't know how he did that. But as a matter of fact, he was really much more interested in the forestry part of the lumber business than the mill, the manufacture of lumber. His interest was in the forest, in caring for them. And I talk about these plantations of conifers, but he spent all of his time, or much of his time, in the woods just doing stand improvement and going into a lot, just a natural hardwood lot, and cutting out all the so-called poor junk trees, low-vigor trees, trees that weren't going to make nice wood so that the others could grow. I mean, that was his way, and of he enjoyed that. And he used to do that all the time. He used to do stand improvement constantly, was constantly doing that. I mean, we grandchildren couldn't get by like even a Thanksgiving. We all lived very close to each other, and we couldn't, if it was Thanksgiving and we weren't having Thanksgiving dinner until 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, then Grandfather was right after us, and we would have to go out and maybe work in the woods for 4 or 5 hours or more. And he thought he enjoyed it so much that maybe we all did too. And, you know, as I look back at it, we should have enjoyed it more, I guess. But it was an important, a very important part of our company, because we planted the trees for years and years, and planted, you know, 1.5 million or more seedlings over that time period. And he used to say that many times we would sit there planning how we were going to keep the business going, or what we were going to do tomorrow, or our fathers would, and we would be just children listening in. But he used to say, you know, he said, I'm doing all of this for you children, you grandchildren. He said, it's nothing. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly true. I mean, forestry is a pretty long-term situation. And oddly enough, a very few years ago, I was measuring a load of logs that came into our little clapboard mill, which still exists. And it was coming off a plantation in Ward Hill. And logs for clapboards have to be pretty big and pretty special, high quality. And some of the logs that were coming in off land that we no longer owned were from the land that had been planted by my grandfather. And there they were coming into the a mill, which was really originally started by his father. And it was pretty interesting. And the logs were 14 to 16 inches. It was the butt log, the first log off the tree. But still, I thought it was pretty nice to have that finally make the cycle.
One of the things that interests me is that I don't know how unique Moortown was, but it seems to me that it was a unique type of town. I mean, there were many big lumber companies operating in Vermont, but this was a town. It was a family, and it was different than the bigger lumber. I sort of want to make sure that we get at that.
Are you thinking of the relationship between the townspeople and the Ward family? And yeah, well, of course, I will give my feeling on that, and I'm sure that other people would have other thoughts about it. It is true that we were the only employer, and in town, and the town really was, that was it, other than, as I say, there were some hill farms, but that was really, then transportation being what it was and all, you sort of stayed in town. And we also owned a general store, which, as I think back at it, was quite a big operation. And there was another store in town too. There were two stores. And our store was an offshoot of, started in maybe my great, the end of my great grandfather's career, Hiram, and my grandfather's too. It started, we used to have lumber camps up the various logging areas, Faiston, Northfield. So much for shutting the power off. That's from my other, must be from the other interview.
Well, you didn't go into it.
No. Well, the store was also a very, it was the social center of town, and I mentioned the how the store originated was, we'll come back to the store, but they used to have to buy barrels of this and kegs of flour and various all various things necessary for the guys to live in the logging camps, which they'd go back and stay in during the wintertime. So I guess that's the way somehow the store evolved and got started. They had to have grain. They had to have, guys had to have clothes. And so that's the way the store got started. As it went along, when I was, the store was well established when I was growing up, and it was open 6 days a week, and it carried everything, that, you know, staples, but it carried everything from grain, of course, all kinds of hardware that you used, not unlike some of the hardware they use today, but still some of it was quite a lot different. All the things necessary for the horses and things necessary for logging. And it carried women's clothes, carried shoes for men and women, dress shoes, work shoes, rubber boots, everything. It had everything. Plus, it had the company offices upstairs. And, of course, another thing that, being part of the family, I was lucky, as I look back on now, I worked in the store a lot of times too. Learned a lot of different, had a chance to learn a lot of varied things. But the men always set, the men that worked in town, and I say the men, it was a social Saturday night. The men would come to the store and they'd sit around. They were sort of like a lot of stools around. I guess they were really milking stools for the farmers. They sold them too, but they managed to get them out. And they would sit around. Actually had a big, what's called a pipeless furnace down in the cellar. So, but they'd sit around that. And it wasn't exactly a stove, but it was where the heat was. And they would tell their experiences of, it was mainly sort of reminiscing, I guess, but they would tell their experiences of what had happened during their day and during the week, or maybe stories of when they were children. And there would be, or all seemed to be sort of lumbering stories more, because that's what they knew and that's what they were familiar with. And at that time, trucks, you see, that was in the 30s, and, well, really, that was in the 30s and early 40s, and trucks were beginning to come in and horses were going out as far as big teams of workhorses around the mill yards and hauling lumber. Trucks were pretty well, we used to ship quite a lot of lumber by rail out of Middlesex. And that was trucks then. But still, we had about 8 teams of horses, which used to be kept in a big barn that we had. which also had its own blacksmith shop, the company blacksmith shop. And so they had great stories, and there was great friction between the teamsters. I remember we had a head teamster. Even then, when the horses were going out, I guess there were seven or eight guys with teams. But there was competition and friction between the truckers, the trucks, and the horses. And in the mill yards, which were really quagmires and just knee-deep mud in the spring, the trucks would get down in there to load lumber, which was all loaded by hand, and this is all hardwood lumber, heavy, and you know, they'd put on the load of lumber, and then they couldn't get out. And they'd try. And then the teams which worked around the mill yards would have to come, and they'd hook on one or two or three teams, and the teamsters would get on the side, and they'd pull the trucks that were loaded out, and that was just so exciting because the teamsters were so proud that the truck couldn't get out without the teams helping them get out. That was a big thing. Because at that time we didn't have, well, not that they didn't exist, but later on we had bulldozers and stuff around there that we did that. But at that time it was the horses. The horses were very exciting. Now I'm rambling here. But,
no, that's good.
Yeah. Well, around these two mills, one at each end of town, you know, there were three or four teams, and they would go back and forth with things. They had these big lumber wagons, which were made, the wheels for the wagons, I can always remember them talking about, came from the artillery pieces in World War I, a lot of them. A lot of the wheels at that time, I mean, before that, I don't know what they used for wheels, but a lot of them, so they were these great big wheels with big steel rims around them. And wooden wheels, of course, wooden spokes and wooden wheels. And we used to have a village, the blacksmith shop, which was at that time run and owned by Will Kingsbury. The company used, the Ward Lumber Company used to have its own blacksmith shop, but which I remember very well. But somehow I relate more to the one that was down in the middle of the village. And so he used to keep all of these teams shod, and he used to do oxen, and he used to bring them in and put them in the big slings like they did oxen, which have, of course, a cloven foot, and raise them up. And he's an amazing guy. He could do anything. And he used to make the wagon wheels. And he would then, after he made the wagon wheel, to put the steel rim, like they would be 4 feet in diameter.
Say that again? After they, because you banged the mic. After they make the wagon
wheel. Well, after they make the wooden wagon wheel, which they'd make the spokes. This is all made out of hardwood, like, various hardwoods. I'm not sure what. Probably ash for the spokes. And I used to use birch for the arc as it went around the wheel. But he'd make all that and put it all together, and then they'd put this steel rim, which was probably 3 inches wide, and they would build a little fire, a little ring of a fire around, 4 feet wide, and this steel band, which was all formed, all connected, would be heated up till it expanded. And when it was just right, he'd flip it over and have the wooden wheel there and put it over the outside of the wooden wheel.
Put it over?
Yes.
He would
put it over the outside of the wheel and then pour water on it and shrink it onto the wheel. So that's how the darn thing stayed on there. It worked pretty well. Now, I drifted off there onto something that...
No, I wanted to go back to the store.
Yes.
Because one of the things I haven't gotten are some of the more exciting accounts of the logging. Can you remember any of the stories they told about their days as loggers?
I wish I could. And maybe, now that you've said that, maybe I will. But it probably would take some time. There were always exciting stories because logging was very dangerous. And at that time, it was all done with axes and crosscut saws. I can remember myself when chainsaws first came out, which was a very revolutionary thing. People did get in trouble and get hurt. I can remember them talking about, the Teamsters talking about how it used to be when they would come down out of off Moortown Common or out of Facedon North and Center Facedon, particularly Center Facedon had a long, long hill. And actually what would happen, they would start about 4 o'clock in the morning in the wintertime. This is when they had to get these logs. They got so many of the logs got to the mill in the wintertime, and they sawed them through the summer as well as sawing through the winter, but because they had to transport them on the snow with snows and on the snow with the big sleds and Travis type sleds. The Teamsters would come and get their teams ready, and they'd leave about 4 o'clock in the morning, each one of them. That's the bells that Otis maybe used to hear some. I'm sure he did, because they'd be on their way to going to Center Facedon or going to Waitsfield or wherever. And they would go up into the woods. In many cases, you'd be talking about going, maybe 7 or 8 miles. And they'd go all the way up into where the logging, to the log landing. And there they'd load up. Which was a real art, and was an art later on the way we used the truck logs. But at that time, knowing just how to put their loads on and how to have the weight and how to have the chains and everything. And then they would come down and they'd make their trip to the mill. And if they had steep hills to go down, they had to put on what's called runner chains, which would wrapped around the runners and would make a drag so that the teams wouldn't get pushed, because the loads of logs going downhill could really push the team, called sluicing the team. And, the guys could get in trouble that way. In fact, teams could teams of horses could get hurt or killed, because if the thing really started to get away or runner chains broke, it'd start to go, and in most cases the driver would jump off, and it was whatever happened. That was a common thing in New England. But anyway, they would make one trip and they would get home, and they'd get to the mill and unload their load, which might consist of 4 or 5 hardwood logs, say maple logs, which would be all a team could handle, and put the horses away. Put the horses away carefully, carefully cared for, and they'd be back again the next morning at 4 o'clock or so to get going to go do that again. And somehow they built up at the mills an inventory of logs so that the mills could run during the summer. And they did get some logs in during the summer, but the wintertime was the time, and I'm sure you've probably heard this story, but I've had it told to me many times about coming out of North Facedon, and they'd get caught in, there'd still be a lot of logs cut and at the landings in the woods, and the weather would break up earlier than it was supposed to, and they could see that the roads were going to get bare. The main, like Route 100, was going to get bare before they got the logs out, which it did sometimes, and they'd shut the two mills down and they'd send up 20 or 30 men with shovels, and the guys would snow the road and shovel the snow from the fields where it was still there onto the road, so that they'd go there at just the right time in the probably the later afternoon when the teams came down. They had all time so that they could get down through from the north face and turn, say, down to the mills in Moortown, which is about 2 miles. So they'd just snow the whole, put the snow on the road and get them down that way. As far as the horse guys really love to talk about how great their horses were and how much they could pull and how they could start these big loads of logs, and you know, that's what the conversation was about. That was Saturday night. That was social time at the store, and it was just very, very interesting. People would come and go, and the farmers would come in off the hills too, and they always had stories to talk back and forth to the guys that were doing the lumbering. So the horses were a very important part of the whole thing. I guess I should mention, which I know has been mentioned before, but the Christmas, which might have been a little unique to Moortown, maybe not wholly, but the Christmas thing, which maybe you've heard before, and I think it was in some other things, but it was very, very, I was just talking to my sister about this yesterday. It was a very high point in our life that the town had on Christmas Eve, the town hall, the same town hall that's there now, they had two huge Christmas trees. And everybody in the village and off the hills too came down and came to the town hall Christmas Eve, and everyone exchanged gifts almost, seems like, with, from a child's view anyway, with everybody else in town. But, you know, people, families gave to other families, and children gave to all the other children.
Maybe we should do this part, that truck. We should do that part again.
Okay.
Sorry.
Anyway, everybody brought their presents and put them on the town Christmas trees. And first there were exercises. We had to do little Christmas exercises, and there's a stage course in the town hall, and everybody had to go out and do their little Christmas songs for the school or various little programs. And then they had the passing out of the gifts, and there was a man who would call, or actually two men, and they were given presents, and they would call your name. And there were little runners that brought the presents around to you. And everybody, it seems like everybody got presents. A lot of people gave their children. As I recall, we got presents from our parents there too. And I think many people did got presents, and there was all the children. There was a bag of candy, one of the little net bags, and the tree was decorated. That was really the Christmas tree decorations, and it had ribbon candy, had all these things in it, and a nice bag of candy. So every child got one of those, and the whole thing was, it was a great, great evening. Then everybody went home and had their own Christmas tree, I guess, that maybe the next day, or we did anyway. I think there were a lot of people that used that as their Christmas tree and didn't really have a Christmas tree at home.
It's not that bad. I think we should
swing it. Okay. It may have been somewhat, as I say, unique to Moortown to have that kind of a get together on Christmas time. Uh, Now where are we?
Well, one of the things I was going to ask you was the changes you've seen in the valley.
Oh, you were also going to ask me, which maybe I got off on a little bit, the relationship of the Ward family.
That's right.
Any recommendations, dog-wise?
The relationship, it was definitely an employer-employee relationship, I suppose. I mean, I saw that more as I got older, but as children, it never seemed like that to me. Nor did it my brother or my cousin, who was really two families. My grandfather had two sons, Kenneth and Merlin, and then our generation, my generation, grew up. And I think maybe I had a sister. I think it was possibly, well, I know it was a little harder for her somehow, because we as boys did everything all the other boys did, and we did them just the same as they did. And it wasn't a problem. As I say, it wasn't a problem maybe for us, but for our parents, it was a little harder. I mean, it was there was a feeling that if you worked for Ward Lumber Company, then you had to buy your groceries at the store, which wasn't the case at all. But they bought their groceries at the store because they could charge them. And then at the end of the week, whatever they charged would be taken out of their pay envelope. And so it certainly was like a company store, but of course, as automobiles came along and everything, in the, you know, end of the, well, even along through the 30s and the beginning of the 40s and everything, pretty soon everybody preferred to go, or not everybody, but many people preferred to go. By then they had a few maybe bigger stores in Montpelier or something, and it was a big outing for them to drive to Montpelier and do their grocery shopping. So that was sort of the end of an era as far as the store, the grocery store business was concerned. In fact, I can recall when we finally stopped having a grocery store or carrying groceries and just carried hardware and maybe a few farm supplies and things, well, a little feed and things. But I mentioned at the beginning, my viewpoint on this might be different than if you talk to one of my peers, although I don't think so all that much. As far as the changes in the valley, once again, I lived in Moortown for probably, I mean, I was born there, born in Montpelier, but really lived there all my life until maybe I was 30 or close to 30, and once again, Moortown was a little somewhat different because as it got to be around see, Mad River Glen started in 48. I was 18. So Mad River Glen got started around 1945 or 46. We sold the land to Mad River. We sold the land that was to become Mad River to Charlie Lord and Roland Palmedo and those people. And that's when things really, really began to change. And as I say, Moortown was a little out of the proximity. I mean, it's part of the Mad River Valley, but really Warren, Faiston, and Waitsfield ended up being the serious ski towns. And it became the changeover from, as I lived in Moortown until maybe I was 28 or 30, and then I lived in Waitsfield for quite a while. But it was a completely the thing changed 100% in how we thought about jobs or how people thought about jobs. Everybody wanted to in some way thought it was going to be great to work for the ski areas, which it was for many people. It created a lot more jobs for women who didn't at that time weren't all that busy, although Montpelier came on later on and needed a lot of people out there for office type work.